Good afternoon and welcome to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg and we're live for an hour each weekday afternoon taking your calls. If you have questions you'd like to raise for discussion about the Bible or about the Christian faith or about your own spiritual journey, your own belief system, feel free to give me a call and we'll discuss it together. If you have an alternative view from that of the host, would like to express that or balance comment, feel free to do so. Here's what you need. This phone number, 1-800-438-5090. Now, we have some lines open right now. We might not in a few minutes, so if you call now, there's a good chance you'll get on. The number is 1-800-438-5090. Our first caller today is Don, calling from Camas, Washington. Don, welcome to The Narrow Path, and thanks for calling.
Hi, Steve. Hey, a couple of comments here. One, yesterday you had a call, a question about the firstborn in the order. And in my many years ago training for counter-cult work, what they taught then was that firstborn referred to not to order of birth, but to status of your position in the family. So when they're referring to Christ, and I'm
right. By the way, you've got an echo on your phone. Are you using a strange device?
I have the phone up to my ear.
Oh, okay, because it was really echoey, but now I think it's better. Go ahead.
Okay, well, I pull over, so I kind of...
Oh, okay, yeah, sorry about that. I hear what you said. I don't know if you needed to say more or not about it, but yeah, in the counter-cult ministries, when they discuss Jesus being the firstborn of all creation in Colossians 1:15, they say firstborn doesn't have to do with chronological order, has to do with status and rank, because the firstborn in the family is the leader or the ruler of the family. And therefore, to say that Jesus is the firstborn of all creation simply would mean that he's the ruler of all creation, is what they would say.
I'm sure you're aware of that. You didn't say that yesterday, and I was really kind of curious as to why.
Yeah, because I don't necessarily accept that as the best explanation.
I should say.
Yeah, in 1 Corinthians, in Colossians 1:15, the verse they're talking about, even the New King James has assumed that explanation to be true, and they've changed it to say he's the firstborn over all creation, which is not really what it says in the Greek. It says he's the firstborn of all creation. So there is the possibility that firstborn does carry the meaning of high rank, although actually there would be much better words and much less confusing words that Paul could have used to express Christ's sovereignty or supremacy. He could have said the king or the ruler, or in fact, those terms are used of him, even Lord. It would mean that. But firstborn would perhaps raise questions as to, you know, why he's using that term. Is it really just a statement about a ruler? Or is he talking about something that really is, he really is the firstborn of the creation? Okay. Now, my position is that verse 18, which is only three verses later, more or less clarifies what he means by calling Jesus the firstborn. He's the firstborn from the dead. So my explanation was a little different than that of, say, Walter Martin or other counter-cult ministries who've always sought to find, you know, a more evangelical way to explain that than what the Jehovah's Witnesses want to say about it.
All right, and I kind of suspected that, given that I knew you knew what you were talking about there, and you didn't bring that up, and I thought, I bet he doesn't think that's he doesn't accept that explanation. Okay, my other comment was still listening back over the archives, trying to catch up from a long vacation. We don't have those very often, but they're nice when you have them.
Yeah.
And and about 2 weeks ago, Mike from Portland had called, and he was asking about why you hadn't written certain books and such. And a comment of yours was that if you saw a gap in a need for a book, you might consider that. And at the time, one book I haven't seen, and so you said you could probably suggest some, would be one like the 4 views, the 5 views, or 20 views, or 100 views, or whatever, of salvation and man's sovereignty, or God's sovereignty, and man's free election, free will. Is there such a book?
Well, you mean the Calvinist-Arminian debate?
Correct.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, yeah. You know, as I'm sure you know, and you probably have heard it, I have that lecture series called God's Sovereignty and Man's Salvation.
I have that on my MP3 player, so I've
listened
to all of that a couple of times, in fact.
Right. The possibility of writing a book about that is not out of the question, but The thing is, there's an awful lot of really good writers who are writing on both sides of that controversy right now, and some books that are comparing them side by side. So, in other words, it's not like it's a totally unbroached topic. It's definitely under discussion, and there are writers better than myself, I think, who are handling it. I don't have any doubt that if I wrote a book on it, it would be a worthwhile book, but I'm not sure that it would stand out, head and shoulders above all other books on the topic.
Well, there's a couple of views other than the two main ones, though, Molinism and some others that may be lesser importance. But
there's Pelagianism, too, Yeah, there's different
views. And just to give not just to argue for the sides, but to explain what the sides are.
Yeah. Well, there's actually a book out that's, I think maybe InterVarsity Press may have published it. I think it's called something like Four Views of Free Will and Predestination and Free Will. Or something like that.
And that's right now. I was wondering if I was actually looking for a book, and so that's why I was asking.
Yeah.
Honestly.
And I believe in one of these books, there's a whole bunch of books out that are four views of this and four views of that nowadays. And this one that I'm thinking of, I believe William Lane Craig may write the Molinist view in it. There's four authors. And so I would think that a book like that would be a much higher value than one that I would write on the four views, especially since I've never really understood the Molinist view. I've tried to. It seems to be like philosophy. You have to be a really kind of astute philosopher to even understand what's being said by the Molinists. And, while it may be a valid view, I don't know. I can't understand exactly what they're claiming. It seems like they're claiming that there's all kinds of possible worlds God could have made where every conceivable thing would have happened, and he made the world, he chose the option where the various things happen, as they do. It strikes me as really an esoteric kind of view, which doesn't make it false. It just makes it kind of above my head.
Right. And I don't know if it's false, just like compatibilism, which I also don't understand totally.
Right.
I don't think it solves the at the root. It doesn't solve the question. I don't think, but I'm not sure. I honestly do not understand either.
I think you're right. I think compatibilism, which is the Calvinist idea that free human agency is compatible with God ordaining all things.
Not sinning, not being responsible for the consequences.
Right, and God not being responsible, man being responsible. This is anyone can make up a word and say this word means that black is white and white is black. Okay, well, you can say it if you want to, but black isn't white and white isn't black. So, to me, compatibilism is self-contradictory, it would seem, because it does say that God ordained all things, and yet that man is responsible for his own deeds, even though they were ordained by God. So anyway, again, maybe there's some really heady philosophers out there who can just really think in abstract categories better than I do. I'm a somewhat simpler man than that, which doesn't make me a better man. Just makes me more limited to what I can address intelligently.
Okay. Well, anyway, I did not. I will look this up by Craig and take a look.
William Lane Craig is a Molinist, and he's. In one of the books, one of the Four Views books, they have four authors, and he's one of the authors. So, like, if you go on ChristianBook.com, I'd type in the words, William Lane Craig, and maybe the word Four Views, and probably the book I'm thinking of will come up. I forget its exact title. It might even just be Four Views, A Predestination of Free Will, but I'm not sure about that.
Okay, years ago I read a book called So Many Views of the Millennium by Klaus.
Klaus, yeah, he's a friend of mine. Yeah, he actually wrote the foreword to my first book for me. Yeah,
didn't he use some different authors in there? I can't remember.
Yes.
I don't have any more. I can't find it.
Yes, Robert Klaus. Robert Klaus is a professor of history in Indiana, I believe. And he put out a series of books. He was the editor of the books, but each book he found four different authors taking four different views on one topic. So he's got. The one on the four views of the millennium is called The Meaning of the Millennium, edited by Robert Klaus, and it has four authors. He's also got four views of women in ministry, and I think his wife collaborated with him on that. Then there's one that's four views of economics, four Christian views of economics, and then there's four views of war. Four Christian Views of War. So those are good books, but he started the genre. He invented the genre of four views, and then other publishers jumped on the bandwagon. Now there's probably 30, I would think there's 30 or more books out there, four views of this or four views of that.
Okay. I like a debate type of a context for, because I think it brings out the best in people, but and I've listened to all of the debates on the website. My only issue, or not, should I say issue, my only thing that would make it better is it was also a transcript, so you get to read it. And if you go back and forth and answer the transcript, because I think it gets lost in the verbal end of it sometimes.
That's true. In a formal debate, you can never answer all the points made by your opponent. You just don't have time.
Yes, I understand that. This is my wish list.
Yeah.
Okay, Steve. Bless you.
Okay, Don. God bless you. Thanks for your call. Bye now. All right, our next caller is Mark from Las Vegas, Nevada. Mark, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, how you doing today?
Good.
Good. I had a question about salvation. I heard some people talking about it. You know, there was like a disagreement. Like somebody was saying that, you know, once you're saved, you know, always saved. And I'm not sure if that's more the dispensationalist view. Mm-hmm. And then there's, you know, views, well, yeah, you can. You know, if you send whatever enough time. I mean, it's funny because I've never really gotten a straight answer on it.
Okay, well, there are three major views about loss of salvation.
Right.
One would be called Calvinism, and one would be dispensationalism, and one would be Arminianism. Those are at least the general labels for them. The Calvinist view is that God has determined before the world began who will be saved and who will not be saved.
Right.
If you happen to be on his list, you're going to get saved. And you're going to stay saved because that was decided before you were ever born. You really don't have much in the way of a free choice in the matter. Okay?
I've met people who believe that, but there was kind of like, you know, they said, right. Well, I know that I'm saved, but, you know, it's like, I don't know.
Well, that's one view.
A logic kind of deal. I don't know.
Yeah, that's one of the views. And on that view, a person might, come to Christ, so to speak, become part of the church, live like a Christian for a while, and then fall away. And on that view, if they do fall away, they are lost. But they were always lost. They, in those times that they seemed to be saved, they were just not really saved. They weren't really one of the elect. Because if they were of the elect, they would persevere to the end. And the fact that they fell away proves they were not saved. Now, that's the Calvinist view on this, that if you're really saved, you will never fall away. Although some people do fall away, that only proves they were never really saved. That's the Calvinist position. Now, the dispensationalist position would be that you can fall away and still be saved. That is, if you're really saved, because you're saved by grace, not by works, there's nothing you could do to save yourself, so they say there's nothing you could do to lose your salvation. Therefore, since it's all of grace, they say, once you get saved, it's a once saved, always saved. It's kind of what they call it. And on that view, if you get saved at any point in your early life, let us say, then you can go off really and do anything evil with the rest of your life. And if you die living an evil life, well, you're still saved because you got that salvation ticket in your pocket from when you're 5 years old. You accepted Jesus in your heart, and you're carrying that salvation with you all the time, even though it doesn't look like it because you're living like the devil. Well, that's called once saved, always saved, and that's the dispensational view. A lot of dispensationalists, when you pin them down, really move a little more toward the Calvinist explanation on that. They'd say, well, if you fall away, you probably weren't really saved. But that's not, that's just moving to a different position. The dispensational view is unconditional eternal security, unconditional once saved, always saved. The Calvinist view is perseverance of the true elect. If you're one of the elect, you'll persevere and stay saved. Then there's the Arminian view, as it's usually called. This is really just the view that was taught by all the church fathers until the time of Augustine. So for the first 400 years of church history, and that's before Arminius was ever born. So it's not really Arminianism, it's just classic Christianity. Pre-Augustinian, because Calvinism began with Augustine, and dispensationalism began in the 19th century. So ancient Christians, before Augustine, taught what we today would probably call Arminianism, although Arminius had not been born yet when they were teaching it. And that is the view that if you're in Christ, you're saved. If you're not in Christ, you're not saved. So conceivably, you might be in Christ at one point and saved, but at a later point, no longer in Christ and no longer saved. So in other words, sometimes the term is used, you can lose your salvation. I don't know that really it's about losing salvation. It's more about throwing it away, because this teaching does not say that if you sin after you're saved, you're lost, or if you sin a certain number of times after you sin, you're lost. After you're saved, you're lost. What it would be saying is, if having come to Christ, you depart from Christ, you are lost. If you apostatize, which means you turn against Christ. Now, some people say, well, every time you sin, aren't you turning against Christ? Not necessarily. Paul said, I do things I hate to do. And Paul said, the flesh lusts against the spirit, and the spirit against the flesh. These two are contrary to each other, so you don't do what you want to do. You see, when a Christian sometimes does sin, because we're weak people, like everybody else. Everybody's weak. We are foolish. We make mistakes. We stumble. I mean, James the Apostle said, in many things we all stumble. All right, so this is a weakness on our part. It doesn't mean we've decided we don't want to be Christian anymore. It doesn't mean we've renounced Christ and said he's not Lord. But some people do go so far as to not want to be Christians anymore. Some people do go so far as to renounce Jesus Christ. Now, the question is, are they saved? Well, the Calvinists would say they never were. The dispensationalists would say, well, they may have been saved earlier, and therefore they're still saved even when they renounce Christ. And the Arminian would say, well, they might have been saved earlier, but when they renounce Christ, they're no longer saved, because abiding in Christ is mandatory for salvation. So those are the three views. I would hold the third view of those three. And there are obviously a lot of Christians on the other sides of that aisle, too.
Thank you. Excellent.
Okay. All right, Mark. God bless you.
Thank you. Yeah, really, that answered very, very well.
Okay,
very
great.
Well.
Great.
Thank you. Bye.
Thank you. Bye now. Okay, Tim from Everett, Washington is our next caller. Tim, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Thanks, Steve. I hope this day finds you well.
So far, thank you.
Before I give my quick question, I was just going to comment on your first caller, the Molinism. I don't know if you've ever seen that Nicolas Cage movie, Next, but that's...
Yes, I did. I did see that. Very interesting movie.
That would be a very visual way to, a simple way to explain the Molinism. When he was in the cafeteria, his will was he wanted to meet her and, you know, take off with her, and he tried several things, so... And ultimately, his will was accomplished, but it was her free will, at the same time. So, I mean, that's a simple way to...
I don't remember the details of the movie. I just remember that there was sort of the concept of the way things could be, or they could be another way.
Right. I think Molinism calls that middle knowledge. You know, when Jesus said, if Sodom and Gomorrah would have had the chance that you would have had, they would have repented, or something like that.
Right. They didn't do it, because they didn't have the chance, but if they had had the chance, Jesus knew what they would do. Yeah.
Right. Anyhow, my question is referring to John 19:13, where John states that Jesus was crucified on the sixth hour, and
Mark 15:25
says that he was on the third hour, and the only explanations I've heard is one says, well, the Alexandrian text says that the John was also the third hour, but that doesn't seem satisfactory to me. And the other one is that is some type of Roman
versus Jewish timekeeping.
Right, but even that, I don't know. Do you have any better explanation?
No, I don't, but I think the Roman versus Jewish timekeeping is reasonable. It's not absolutely certain that John used Roman timekeeping. He does give John in his gospel does give a number of time frames. And for example, he'll talk about something happening at the sixth hour, and it's not clear if this is six in the evening or six in the morning, you know, or if it's actually noon. Because by Jewish reckoning, which Mark seems to follow anyway, by Jewish reckoning, the day begins at 6 in the morning. And so when Mark says in Mark 15:25 that Jesus was crucified at the third hour. Well, by Jewish reckoning, that's 9 in the morning. The day begins at 6, so 9 o'clock is the third hour. Remember that Peter, on the day of Pentecost, when he was explaining that this phenomenon was not drunkenness, he said, "It's not; these people are not drunk as you suppose. It's only the third hour of the day." He means 9 in the morning. And so does Mark mean, I think, in when he says that it was the third hour when they crucified him, 9 in the morning. Now, John, in chapter 19, tells us that while Jesus was still standing before Pilate, still on trial, not yet crucified, it was the sixth hour, it says. Now, this looks like a contradiction because Mark said that Jesus was crucified at the third hour, and John said, well, at the sixth hour, which seemingly would be 3 hours later, Jesus was still standing before Pilate, not yet condemned. So some have felt, and I think there's a good case for this. I couldn't argue that it's absolutely the correct answer. But it seems that John, who was writing in Ephesus, a Roman colony, would normally use the Roman means of reckoning. And it is believed by most scholars, although this too is uncertain, it is believed that by most scholars that the Romans used the same way of reckoning the hours of the day that we use, beginning at midnight. Whereas the Jews begin at 6 in the morning, the Romans would use midnight as the beginning point, just like we do. So when John, using that reckoning, said that Jesus stood before Pilate at the sixth hour, if he's using Roman reckoning, the assumption is it's 6 in the morning. Now, that'd be very probable, because actually the Jews held a nighttime session of the Sanhedrin to condemn Jesus, and first thing in the morning, they took him to Pilate, as soon as it was dawn. So 6 in the morning would make sense there. To say that it was noon doesn't, it's possible. I mean, it would be possible for Jesus' trial before Pilate to last from daybreak until noon. It depends on how long all this took. But the suggestion is that when John says it was the sixth hour, he means it was 6 in the morning when Jesus was on trial. When Mark says it was the third hour when he's crucified, he means 9 in the morning. And that would mean that the trial and so forth until Jesus' crucifixion was 3 hours long.
Yeah, and I was thinking his crucifixion was 6 hours, from 9 to noon, and then at noon it became dark, and then at 3 he gave up.
That's correct. That's how I understand it also.
So I also heard it's possible that it could have been a Roman idiom by saying that at noon it was just, at that time frame.
In the middle of the day?
Yeah.
I personally feel, there are other ways to explain this, like you said, but almost all my life I've felt that it's referring to Roman time in John's Gospel. I read an argument for that many, many years ago when I was younger, and it seems to me, as I've looked it over, it seems reasonable.
Okay, and I had one last question. We're having Shane Wood come to our church speaking on Revelation, and I've listened to his lectures, and I think he's an idealist, although it seems he borrows a lot of his images from your teaching.
Shane Wood, I'm not familiar with him. What kind of church do you go to?
I go to a non-denominational, but...
Uh-huh.
But
it's not particularly a dispensational church?
Well, I think, probably most of the pastors there probably have gone through, the traditional.
Yeah. Well, I will say that many people who are idealists mix up the idealist view, that is elements of it, with the elements of the preterist view. I myself, though I call myself a partial preterist, I mix in some elements of the idealist view myself. The two views are very compatible. They make different claims, but they are not mutually exclusive. That is, of course, the preterist view holds that Revelation is talking about things that were fulfilled in the first century, especially with the destruction of Jerusalem primarily. But the idealist view holds that the visions are depicting timeless truths about spiritual warfare and God's sovereignty and vindication of martyrs and things like that, all of which could be true regardless what time frame it's talking about. In other words, it could be that it's describing the destruction of Jerusalem, but it's trying to end in the visions about that it's underscoring certain true you know, theological facts of God's sovereignty and judgment and so forth. So it's not unheard of at all. In fact, it's a very common thing for idealists to buy into some elements of the preterist view.
Yeah, it seemed that the rules of interpretation were very similar, just the outcome of the interpretation was slightly different.
It's not as common for a person who calls himself a preterist to buy into elements of the idealist view, but I always have. The truth is, I was a futurist for many years, of course, and then I was an idealist. The first view other than the futurist view that I ever encountered personally was the idealist view. I read a really convincing book called More Than Conquerors by William Hendrickson, which was a very persuasive book, and it was the first time I'd heard anything other than the futurist view, and I was persuaded. And so for a few years, I took the idealist view myself. But then I became acquainted with the preterist view and realized that in many respects it was stronger. I felt it was it answered to one fact that idealism does not. And that is, the idealist view does not hold that there's any particular fulfillments of the visions, but rather they're just ideas. They're just ideals and facts, truths that are played out many times in history in different situations. But Revelation begins, the opening verse says, these are things that must shortly take place. So, you know, the book of Revelation does claim to be written about events that are predicted. But there's no reason why those events couldn't also in themselves be illustrative of those principles that the idealists see in there. And I have become a partial preterist in my view of Revelation, I still hold to an idealist understanding of many parts of it.
Okay, yeah, me too. I don't want to get you down that path. I think it was me 10 days ago that brought up a question, and then the whole rest of the time was down this same...
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we had every call after that was about Revelation, right?
Yeah, I don't want to start you down that path.
No, that's not a desirable way to go. Everyone then calls in and wants to vote for their view of Revelation instead of add something to the discussion. Yeah.
All right,
Tim.
Hey, Steve, thanks.
Hey, thanks for your call.
Bye.
Bye now. All right, Judith from Phoenix, Arizona, thank you for waiting, and thanks for calling. Welcome to the Narrow Path.
No problem. I never mind waiting.
All right.
Good afternoon, Brother Steve.
Yes.
I just want to say, first of all, to all of my brothers and sisters in Radio Land, wherever, Jesus bless you, and I hope everyone's having a really wonderful day. I have a question, and several years ago, I was reading just before the crucifixion of Jesus when Pilate's pagan wife had a dream.
Mm-hmm.
And she instructed Pilate, don't have anything to do with this just man. On a broadcast, a week or so ago, someone brought up that some people believe or speculate that Claudia, Pilate's wife, could have been a secret worshiper of Jesus. And when I read about the crucifixion and the dream, it troubled me. I don't know, my spirit felt very troubled, and I just want to know what you think about Claudia, Pilate's wife.
Okay, well, we know very, very little about Pilate's wife. The truth is, we know relatively little about Pilate. He was a man who, for some time, skeptics were saying Pilate never existed and that the Bible just made him up. But then a great deal was found, archaeologists found a great deal of confirmations of Pilate's reign in Palestine. So we do know Pilate existed. We don't know very much about his wife, whether she was a Christian or not. Her claim, the message she sent Pilate when he had Jesus on trial, was to have nothing to do with him because she'd suffered many things in a dream concerning Jesus and that he was a just man. So she had some kind of a dream that at least warned her that this was not going to go well for Pilate and perhaps her if he condemned Jesus. Now, whether she had a dream sort of like what a lot of Muslims are having now, I'm sure you've heard of the Muslims in many countries are having dreams about Jesus and becoming Christians. Maybe she did too. Maybe Jesus appeared to her and said, you know, Claudia, why do you, you know, why do you reject me? But we don't read that that's what happened. We read that she was troubled. She had a troubling dream, and it made her, you know, the Romans were very superstitious people, and they put great stock in dreams anyway. And so she just thought it was some kind of a portent. She might have thought it was a portent from the gods. After all, Jesus, she described him simply as a just man. And the gods of Olympus would be concerned about the fate of just people and not being condemned and so forth. So I think whether she was a Christian or not, and I don't know that she was, I don't have any knowledge of that. I think she might have still been on the right side of that particular trial, that particular judgment. And so that's why I think she could have warned Pilate safe. You know, he could have made the right decision. I think he was inclined to. I mean, it says in Acts, Chapter 2, that the Jews persuaded or blackmailed Pilate into killing Jesus when Pilate was persuaded and determined to let him go. So we know that Pilate on several occasions tried to release Jesus. I find no fault in this man. Let me release him. He got shouted down and he got basically blackmailed by the chief priest, who said, well, you know, if you don't crucify him, we're going to tell Caesar that you're, you know, aiding and abetting a person who claims to be king of the Jews, and only Caesar's the king of the Jews, so that won't go well for you, is what they're implying. And certainly Pilate knew that was true, and he wasn't willing to take that chance, so he did what he knew was wrong, even though his wife and his conscience told him otherwise. Kevin from Amity, welcome to the Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, this is Kevin.
I know. Hi, Kevin.
How you doing? Well, I called about that dispensational position that they're once saved, always saved.
Uh-huh.
I'm not sure where you got that, because in my experience, I got saved and I was in a Baptist church, and of course they were once saved, always saved.
Yeah.
Dispensational. And I lived with my aunt and uncle who were Assembly of God, and they were dispensational, and they believed you could lose your salvation. I had a guy, kind of a church organizer, went around visiting dispensational churches, and he came by, and I put him up for a night, and we talked, and he said half the churches were Armenians.
Are Armenian in their thoughts? Yeah, the reason I called that second view dispensational is because I've never encountered it except in dispensational churches. Like yourself, I was in a Baptist church, and it was dispensational. I was in Calvary Chapel, and they were dispensational, and Chuck Smith believed in once saved, always saved. And I encountered it among dispensationalists. As soon as I got out from dispensational churches, I didn't encounter it anymore. Now, excuse me, I think that like the Assemblies of God and other Pentecostal groups, they have bought the dispensational eschatology, but they're not dispensational thoroughly, I think. And so that would perhaps explain why they believe that you can lose your salvation. Because I'm pretty sure the strictest dispensationalists I know of, Charles Ryrie, for example, and Zane Hodges, they're against even the teaching of lordship salvation. They don't want you to teach that you have to have Jesus as your Lord to be saved. They've got really kind of an antinomianism, and yet they are major dispensational teachers. Now, I guess I shouldn't suggest that everybody who holds to dispensational eschatology would hold to this once saved, always saved doctrine. But it's among dispensationalists that you find it. You know, you may also find dispensationalists who don't hold it.
Well, do you think that the dispensational theology, I don't see that it leads to... it leads one way or the other as far as an interpretation of soteriology.
Well, many of the dispensational churches I attended had a certain understanding of grace that, to my mind, would encourage this once saved, always saved thing. They didn't see grace necessarily as something that teaches you that denying ungodliness and worldly lust, you should live soberly and righteously and godly in this present world, like Paul said grace teaches us to do. But they just saw grace as God's blanket approval, you know, regardless of what you do. I mean, in other words, if there was any suggestion that you had to live a Christian life, they would have said that's salvation by works. That's not grace. Grace, by definition, is unmerited. And if it's unmerited, if you can't deserve it, you can't deserve to lose it either. You know? And so this is, I think, the view that many dispensationalists have, not all. Like you say, you're right, Pentecostal churches, they do believe you can lose your salvation, and yet they embrace most of dispensationalist eschatology anyway.
Now, in my experience, the people that claim, you know, well, you get saved, now you can go do whatever you want, that's kind of a, how do you say?
That's a red herring. No one really says that.
It's an uneducated type. I mean, it's people who might say something like that.
Yeah, no one really says, now that you're saved, you can do whatever you want. I mean, that's a little coarse, you know. But actually, it's what they believe. They no one in any denomination ever wants to encourage people to go out and sin, I don't think. But yet some hold as a theological position that if you just go out and live in sin, it's not going to have any negative impact on your salvation.
Now, in your experience, and I really don't know this, but you're bound to run across more belief systems and so forth. Is once saved a description of kind of summary of a Calvinist type view, you know, or is it a doctrine in itself?
Once saved, always saved? Well,
yeah.
You know, now you're both Calvinist, you're dispensational and Calvinist. So I think that your views on this probably are probably more dominantly Calvinistic than the other, right?
Right.
I mean, right, because the Calvinist view holds, of course, that you can't lose your salvation, but you can certainly appear to have a salvation that isn't real, and you can prove that you don't have it by backsliding, right?
Right.
Yeah. See, like I said, a lot of dispensationalists I know, when you pin them down on it, they would actually say that too. And in which case, they're coming over to the Calvinist way. But there is a difference. I mean, because there are certainly people out there who say you can backslide and still be saved. The Calvinist view is, if you backslide, you never were.
Now, is that a doctrinal position? Like, you know, Calvinism is a doctrinal teaching.
Yeah.
Is that actually formulated, or is that once saved, always saved, or is that just kind of a shortcut?
Just an opinion some people have. I don't know of any church creed that, you know, has formulated once saved, always saved, unconditional eternal security kind of a creed in quite such a crass manner. But it is the private opinion of a great number of people who apparently don't understand as well as they should what it means to be saved by grace.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay, well, that was all I wanted to talk about.
Okay, oh, Kevin.
No, let's argue over Revelation.
Oh, someday, not now.
I heard you say you didn't want to, so.
Yeah.
All right, thanks a lot, Steve.
Okay, Kevin, great talking to you again.
All right.
Bye now. All right, Phil from Albany, Oregon. Welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Yes, hello, Steve. I have a question about, we all know that Peter was executed by the Romans, but I hear some people say that Peter never actually was in Rome physically. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, I've encountered very few who would deny that Peter was ever in Rome physically. I did encounter that in a full preterist book once. The author was trying to prove that Peter lived and died in Jerusalem because he wanted to make Peter out to be one of the two witnesses in Revelation, you know. But I don't think he had a very strong argument. The tradition of the church is very strong. Now, if someone says, well, that's just tradition, it's not proof. Well, that's true. I mean, tradition isn't proof. But when we talk about a tradition, and the tradition we're talking about is like the whole church in the first three centuries or something believed that a certain thing happened to Peter. You know, we'd need to have some tradition of comparable strength to make any other view credible. You know, I mean, I have always assumed that since the early church venerated the apostles as much as they did, that the early church would do its very best to remember what happened to them, how they died, and so forth. Because, I mean, who wants to, I mean, unless you're making up a religion from scratch and you don't care about truth, and you just want to, you know, make up, you know, legends and so forth. But my impression from reading the Church Fathers is these were men who gave their lives for their faith, just like the apostles did. Most of the Church Fathers either almost died as martyrs or actually did die as martyrs. And this being the case, I can't really believe that they were interested in perpetrating a false view of something so important.
Can you give me any scriptures that says that Peter was in Rome?
No, no. The Bible doesn't record Peter going to Rome. The last we read about Peter is in Acts chapter 15. I mean, that's the last we read in the historical accounts of Peter. And he's in Jerusalem there at the Jerusalem Council. And so was Paul, and so were Barnabas and so forth. But Paul and Barnabas, after that, did a great deal of traveling. Two more missionary journeys that we know of. And Paul himself ended up in Rome after that time. We don't know what happened to Peter after that time, except from the traditions of the church. And the traditions of the elders is that he went to Rome and he died there.
So it is tradition. Okay.
Yes.
A short thing. Do we can still today go to physical places that the Apostle Paul actually visited? Some of those old city or...
Yeah, some of them.
Yeah, like which?
Well, the Areopagus, for example, in Greece, you know, Mars Hill in Athens. We know of some of the places that Paul stood. There's a pavement in Corinth where Paul almost certainly had walked across it at one time or another. I mean, there are certain towns that Paul preached in, synagogues in places like Corinth and Berea and Thessalonica and so forth. And
wow.
In some of those cases, you can actually go there. And more than that, you can go to places where Jesus walked.
And
now,
still original cobblestones and stuff like that?
Probably not. Probably they've been redone over the centuries.
Mm-hmm.
After all, you know, things change a lot in 2,000 years.
Yeah.
When I went to Israel, I was looking forward to going to places where Jesus had been, but it's awfully hard to determine exactly what places he was at.
Wouldn't it be in the Garden of... And the
Mount of Olives, yeah, and the Garden of Gethsemane. Yes, that's at least one place.
It hasn't completely disappeared yet, has it?
No, it has not disappeared. I went there, and I mean, there are certain places where we know for sure Jesus was. Other places are traditional, like a traditional site of the Sermon on the Mount or the traditional place, even the traditional tomb of Jesus, the Garden Tomb. There are different traditional places for some of these things, but the Garden of Gethsemane is still there on the Mount of Olives. Yeah,
has it been cut down a little bit, or is it the same size?
Well, I wouldn't know. I wouldn't know how big it was in Jesus' day, and I'm not sure they're the same trees there as were growing when he was there, although olive trees can live very, very long, and they might be, some of them. But I'll tell you, one place that didn't change very much, it seemed to me, was the shore of the Sea of Galilee at Capernaum.
Sea of Galilee.
Yeah, and there's a synagogue in Capernaum. It's in ruins now, and it's actually built on an older synagogue. But the older synagogue is where Jesus preached. And we know that, Capernaum was a major... a home for Jesus during his ministry. He basically had his base of operations out of Capernaum, came and went. Sometimes they, you know, crossed the Sea of Galilee in the boat and stuff from there. So standing on the shore of that sea and realize that, you know, Jesus spent months in this place, and certainly every spot along this shore he had been at one time or another. You know, to stand somewhere and say, I know for a fact Jesus stood somewhere right around here, or to go into the ruins of the synagogue in Capernaum and say, you know, I know that Jesus preached here in this synagogue. I mean, I don't know exactly what spot he stood on, but it was, you know, within feet of where I'm standing. It's kind of an awesome thing.
Would he have come in contact with the Wailing Walls that are still standing?
Well, yes, he would have, but he wouldn't have wailed there. The Wailing...
No, I know that, it's still the original wall?
Well, I think so. I think it is. See, the Wailing Wall... I don't know exactly when it was built, but it certainly would not have been built after the destruction of Jerusalem. The Wailing Wall is a retaining wall. It's not a wall of the temple.
Yes.
It's a retaining wall that holds the earth up so that they could form the temple mount where they could build the temple. The temple is completely gone now, but before building the temple, they would have to have built that wall. And so since the temple was standing in Jesus' day, that wall must have been standing there too.
Oh, that's cool, because I like to take a trip to Israel, and I just wanted to.
Uh-huh.
Do you have any comments on the things you can see in Israel that are very
one thing you can
to the
see,
original things?
One thing you can see is a bunch of little Jewish and Arab boys with their hands out asking for money to show you where David was buried and where Jesus, you know, scratched his head and so forth. It's basically a tourist trap now. I mean,
so
I was
I'm wasting my money then.
Well, you could waste a lot of money there, but I mean, there's
it's there, not the truth, right?
Well, right. I mean, you just don't know. There's a bunch of people who are making a lot of money trying to show tourists places that are supposed to be holy places. Many of them, we have no idea whether they are holy places or not. But there, like I said, there are some places that certainly. You know, we know Jesus walked through the Eastern Gate, you know, or we know that that Jesus walked on the Sea of Galilee in Capernaum and so forth. We know he preached in the synagogue there. So, I mean, you certainly can find spots where you have no doubt that Jesus was there, and that's meaningful.
Where is the area supposed to be where he fed the thousands of people?
You mean for the feeding of the 5,000?
Yes.
Yeah, nobody knows that exact site, but I think there's a traditional spot for it.
It has to be because that's a lot of people to be in one place.
Yeah, yeah. Now, you know, one place I really liked, and I know Jesus went there, is a place called Panias.
Panias.
It was called Caesarea Philippi in the Gospels, and Jesus took his disciples there, and that's where he said, "Who do men say that I am?" And then he said, "Who do you say I am?" You know, and that's that famous conversation he had at Caesarea Philippi. That spot is really amazing because it's the headwaters. It's where the Jordan River comes out of the ground, and it's very interesting. It has a colorful history. But there are three different locations where waters come out of the ground and they eventually join to be the Jordan River.
Okay.
But this is up at the very top, and you can actually see the water coming out of the ground.
Wow.
From under the rocks. It's really an amazing thing.
In your vast library, which you have, do you have anything on visiting Israel?
I bought a book while I was there about visiting Israel, but I don't remember ever using it. I didn't have much time to be a tourist when I was there. I was teaching. I was only there for 2 weeks, and I was teaching in a school.
But you've never written anything yourself?
No. And I probably wouldn't. You know, like I said, if you go to Israel, there's some very meaningful places you can see there. But there's an awful lot that was disappointing, and that is that the old city of Jerusalem, to a very large extent, it struck me as being like a religious theme park. You know, there's people trying to make money. On the other hand, you see the Eastern Orthodox, you know, clerics walking around in their long black robes and stuff like that. They almost look like, you know, they'd be like the Pharisees. You also have the Hasidic Jews walking around similarly.
Well, I've seen that in New York.
Yeah, that's right. And they're not real friendly. They're not real friendly.
Well, they're not aggressive either. They're just to themselves.
Yeah, they keep to themselves pretty much.
Seems to me
unless they catch you preaching. If they catch you preaching the gospel on the street, they will not keep to themselves. They'll engage you.
Thank you, but I wish you had something written yourself of your travels in Israel.
No, I have not. I have not.
Okay, thank you very much for taking the time.
Okay, Phil. God bless you, man. Good talking to you. All right, Michelle from Seattle, Washington, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi, I was following up on your, I had a question in relationship to the discussion with the, related to the different positions of salvation, the Arminian, the Calvinist, and the dispensational.
Uh-huh.
And just as a note, I'm so appreciative that you are somebody that is willing to acknowledge that Christians of goodwill, you know, can see things differently and,
mm-hmm.
and also acknowledge the complexity of the Bible. But what my question is I grew up in an exceedingly Lutheran family. Almost all of us were lots of Lutheran pastors, and most of us were educated in Lutheran seminaries or universities, myself included. And, of course, you know, Luther was responding to, he felt like he rediscovered Paul. And, you know, of course, I'm not telling you anything that you don't know.
Uh-huh.
It's just in prep to my question. You know, he felt that within the Catholic Church that there was a works righteousness and that he rediscovered Paul in grace. And of course, I grew up, you know, being educated that, you know, a great deal of emphasis on faith and, of course, baptism. as part of the saving agents. But I always felt really comforted by the idea that there was really nothing that I could do to earn God's love, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true.
And yet the really funny thing is that it never really occurred to me until my adulthood and that what about those other people, that did nothing and yet were apparently didn't love God, right? And I was just curious, did within Luther's, I grew up a Lutheran, and I don't know the answer to this. Did he ever really develop, obviously Calvin developed his understanding of what it really, the folks that aren't saved weren't saved because they were never destined to be saved. But did Luther ever develop that in terms of how he addressed that?
Well, Luther and Calvin, of course, lived in different generations. And,
okay.
And Luther was earlier, a generation earlier than Calvin.
Yes.
And as you know, Calvin is the one who developed the Reformed theology in his book, Institutes of the Christian Religion, and his many commentaries on biblical books. Calvin's...
Well, what's funny, I mean, as a Lutheran, we were told that Luther was the reformer, you know.
Well, he was. He was.
Yeah.
Yeah, Luther was the reformer. And in Germany and in Switzerland, Zwingli was. But a generation later, Calvin was the main reformed leader. And what Calvin did that the others did not do is he wrote out a complete systematic theology for the Reformation, which Luther and Zwingli didn't do that. Now that doesn't mean that Zwingli and Luther didn't have strong opinions about a lot of doctrinal things and didn't work out a lot of stuff. They did. But as far as putting it into a comprehensive systematic theology, Luther didn't do that. He did a lot of things, but he didn't do that. So the theology of the Reformation is usually traced to Calvin, though it wasn't that much different than Luther's, because both Luther and Calvin were Augustinians. Luther, as a Roman Catholic, was an Augustinian monk, and that means he followed the teachings of Augustine. Well, Calvin was an Augustinian Catholic priest before he was a reformer, and so they both held Augustinian beliefs, and those beliefs include things, that Calvinists would say today, about free will and the bondage of the will and the denial of free will. Both Calvin and Luther denied free will, and they both believed in predestination, unconditional predestination, and so forth. So, in a sense, although Lutheranism and Calvinism are not the same in all points, on those points, they're very, very similar. And so pretty much, I mean, Lutherans don't believe everything Calvinists do about these things, but they're very close because they're both Augustinian. And Augustine is the one who came up with what they usually call the doctrines of grace, what Calvinists refer to as that. I don't know all of the nuances of Luther's theology for the simple reason that he didn't systematize it as thoroughly as Calvin did. So we're more familiar with Calvin's ideas on every little thing. As Luther, we know he had his issues with the Catholic Church, and he wrote very much about them, and we were familiar with those. Anyway, I just need to, I'm going to sign off here because I'm out of time, but you might want to read Luther's Bondage of the Will to find out how he felt about human nature and predestination and things like that, because that's one of his theological treatises on that kind of stuff. All right, you've been listening to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg. We do this Monday through Friday for an hour each day and take your calls. We have a website with lots of resources that are free to you as well. Just go there and take them. They're free. The website is thenarrowpath.com. Now, we don't have anything for sale, but we do have expenses. Those expenses are just radio time. There's no paid staff here, but we do pay for the radio time we use. And we depend on donors for that. If you want to go to our website, thenarrowpath.com, you can find out how you can donate to help keep us on the air. Till then, may God bless you, and we'll talk again tomorrow, Lord willing.